Hello, I'm Anne McElvoy, and this is BBC Radio 3's Arts and Ideas podcast, bringing together leading artists, writers and thinkers in discussions which try to answer a range of questions, from should we keep pets to what does it mean to belong, or what can Nietzsche teach us? So stay with us for one of those conversations, coming up right after this short message.
Why does music move us? How does it do it?
Well, hello. The question of what immigrants contribute to British culture may be a political hot potato today, but we'll be looking back to the 1930s and 40s to consider the impact of the émigrés who came to these shores to escape the Nazis. We'll also hear from a writer whose new novel explores the Holocaust and music, particularly Bach's cello suites. But first, the World Economic Forum's annual meeting at Davos concluded at the weekend. It's the annual gathering of money, glitz and good intentions, with a guest list that ranges from Bill Gates to Matt Damon, Sting and the IMF's chieftain, Christine Lagarde. In these days of populist pushback against elites, Davos has a vaguely guilty feel, even if it tends to be washed away by good wines and late-night parties. This year, globalisation, the slowing pace of global commerce, was an overarching theme, and one hotly debated subject was a decline in trust in valued institutions. Well, that coincides with the annual publication of the public affairs company Edelman's Trust Barometer, measuring who and what we trust, and who and what we don't. Ed Williams is CEO of Edelman. So, Ed, you do this every year. What's changed in 2019 or the year up to now?
Well, the volatility that we've seen in politics around the world and in markets, if you like, and the changes in technology have all resulted in this kind of shifting sand of trust in institutions. We are seeing much greater levels of pessimism than we've seen in the past. People are concerned about their own personal economics. They're concerned about what impact technology is going to have on them. They worry about things like automation. But one of the commonalities, I suppose, that we see this year with past years is that gap between the trust that those who are in positions of power have in institutions versus the rest.
So you mean the problem solvers are not seen as trustworthy?
Well,
give me an example.
It's interesting. So we look at, in our work, and we've been studying this topic of trust now for, gosh, almost 20 years, we look at two different groups of people. We look at trust in the institutions of government, business, media and NGOs, and of course in leaders as well. And we look at one group that we call the informed publics, and those are people who are in higher income brackets, they are university educated, and they are regular consumers of media. And then we look at the mass population, if you like, everybody else. And that gap between the trust that the informed publics have in institutions and the mass public have is quite large, actually. We've seen record spikes this year in countries like Canada and in France and in the US. And we're also seeing that gap emerging in developing economies like India and China. I think what's particularly interesting and relevant here in the UK is that gap has closed considerably in the last few months, as I think politics has become more volatile, as Mrs. May's Chequers deal has unravelled.
And so what would the effect of that be on broadly how people feel about institutions and elites? Are we clear that the trust rating goes in one direction only, or does it bounce around? Are people untrustworthy about trust?
I mean, I think what's particularly interesting is if you think about this bigger question around kind of fairness and injustice, the notions that the social contract that we've had in the past, that you work hard, work hard, you know, you put in the hours, you'll earn income, and you know your life will improve. You put your kids through good schools, you'll be able to go on nice holidays, and so on and so forth. There's a feeling now that that system isn't working in the way that it's worked in the past.
And I wonder where this leaves Davos, man and woman. And we should say, full guilty disclosure, we were both up that mountain Some of us in the cheap seats. But it is a gathering of star power. But this year I had the feeling that a lot of leaders stayed away or wanted to signal that they weren't quite part of these elites, even if they were passing through. So we didn't get Donald Trump. We didn't get Emmanuel Macron. Theresa May was otherwise detained trying to get a deal through Parliament. Even Angela Merkel, who's a stalwart of Davos, kept quite a low profile. I mean, maybe I just went to different events to you. What did you think?
It's understandable that when you look at the domestic challenges that Emmanuel Macron is facing, and at the time the shutdown in government in the US, it's obviously not a great look then to be hobnobbing with the rich and powerful up a mountain. I must say that I did sort of laugh when I heard the interview with the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, in which he was asked, do you feel isolated in the world? And he said, absolutely not. Of course, that was via a satellite link to Washington.
The big theme, I think, of the week in terms of the economics was, I was about to say snowballisation, but I think I really mean slowballisation. Slowballisation being the fact that global trade is dropping off. There's been quite a consistent fall in its volume, which sounds quite boring until you realise that that's quite a lot of money that isn't being made in trade, and this goes very quickly into the billions. Is that something that you're seeing businesses? I know you also consult with lots of businesses and they share their fretfulness with you. Do they worry about that?
Yeah, look, I think everyone's worrying about the slowdown at the moment. I mean, I think what's interesting, actually, when we see it in our survey, is that worry about the macro economy is filtering down to people's personal worry about their own economics. Mm. So since the referendum, the number of people who feel that they're going to be better off this time next year has halved. It's just 11% of people in the UK now who think that this time next year they're going to be millionaires.
They don't know, but they feel it or they expect it.
Yeah, they feel it. Yeah. They worry about it. And the number of people who feel that actually we're going to be worse off, it's almost half of all of us now. So you see this trickle-down effect, this anxiety, this contagion now coming through to consumer attitudes. I mean, I think the interesting point about business and what's on businesses' mind at the moment is this real desire that employees want businesses to lead and they want CEOs to step up in a way that they haven't before. All the things that they're concerned about in the workplace, like inequality, like discrimination, training for the future, protect me from, you know, my job being replaced by a robot, and automation, they're looking to CEOs now to step up because they're feeling they're not getting answers elsewhere in the world.
Is this realistic? One of the CEOs I was talking to said, look, I've done everything to make my company loved. I've done some of the good stuff. I've got the sustainability in place. I like to think I'm good in terms of diversity of my workforce and getting better. But I still don't find that my company is loved. I'm still under attack. There are quite a lot of populist forces left and right wanting to have a go at big capital. So why should I do any more of the nice stuff? Hasn't he got a point?
I mean, look, it's not easy. So I can understand for many chief executives why it may feel difficult to do it. However, you have to understand now, and I think we talk to our clients a lot about this, you have to understand that their employees are expecting them to do it.
We should just mention the Huawei situation, big trade standoff there, but it's not just trade, it's technology, it's intellectual property, it's geopolitics. So the Chinese delegation will be turning up there to make its protest this week. That's exactly the kind of standoff that is built on a massive trust breakdown. I mean, I'm not suggesting that you could write in and solve the Huawei problem single-handedly, but what do you do when there are just simply two completely different competing views of what's OK to do in business?
We've talked about the clash of civilizations in geopolitics for many years. Huntington's book on this topic was written, actually, I think it was almost 20 years ago now.
Samuel Huntington, the clash of civilizations.
Clash of civilizations, yeah. What we're seeing now is a clash of technological civilizations. And I think that's really interesting. I mean, the US has had market dominance, global dominance in technology really since the 50s. And if you think about the internet itself, it is by and large controlled by America. Meanwhile, on another part of the planet, China has been making these extraordinary advances. I mean, just look at what they're doing in the space race. But it's not absurd to suggest that China is going to start to advance the US and other developed Western democracies in technology and things like AI. They're certainly moving at real speed on technologies like face recognition and so on and so forth. So we're now seeing this clash, not of civilizations, but this clash of technologies. It's really unclear to me who's going to win out.
And one last word on, as we look back to Davos and what it might mean. I was certainly struck by the way geopolitics impacts business relations, to the extent that although China and America in this huge standoff appears to be getting worse at the moment around the Huawei case, there was still a lot of occasions where Chinese top business people sat down at dinner and hashed it out, argued with their American counterparts. I didn't notice that free-flowing information as much going between, say, the Americans or the European delegations and Russia. You can almost feel when a freeze has come down. Any last-minute sort of mental pictures of Davos that you brought home with you?
I think the theme of trust came out very clearly. And the risk that we face in respect to trust evaporating in the institutions that have served us so well since World War II.
And you don't think that the decline in trust is also inevitable, even if the world were in a better place, and we hope that it will be, because we know much more. And your trust ratings, when you went into your business, looking at this kind of thing, getting public affairs to work with trust ratings would probably have just been easier if we didn't know as much.
So you make a very profound point about trust. Is the end state, is a good state, if you like, total trust in institutions, in business, in government, in media and NGOs? No, it isn't. Because I think what do we want in society? We want an informed society who are able to hold power to account. I mean, that is the job of the media, and that's the job, I spent a big part of my career here at the BBC, and that is the job of institutions like the BBC to do just that. If we just have blind faith, blind trust in institutions, the risk then of those institutions, I think, getting up to no good, acting in a way that's not in the public interest is quite high. So I think your point about, what's the right level of trust to have a functioning society is a really interesting one.
Thank you, Ed Williams. You're listening to Free Thinking with me, Anne McElvoy, available on Radio 3 and as an Arts and Ideas podcast. If you browse through the extensive archive on the Free Thinking website, you'll find Douglas Carswell talking to Matthew Sweet about our distrust of elites, among many other ways of constructively whiling away 45 minutes, and we'll allow you a cup of tea too. If you'd like to join me at the London School of Economics on Tuesday, the 19th of February, I'll be hosting a discussion on leadership. Details of how to attend are also on the website, and it's free. Now, a poll marking Holocaust Memorial Day has just revealed that 5% of British adults don't believe that the Holocaust happened, and 8% say that the scale of the genocide has been exaggerated. As the number of survivors who can bear witness to the events diminishes, the role of writers and artists in keeping this history alive is even more important. Martin Goodman is Professor of Creative Writing at the University of Hull, and his new novel, J.S.S. Bach, traces the journey of a talented young cellist, Otto Schamlich, from his parents' home in Vienna to the concentration camp at Dachau. There he's forced into an uncomfortable musical relationship with the camp adjutant Birkendorf and his wife, one which will reverberate through the following 5 decades. Martin, could you start us off with an extract?
Birkendorf had re-entered the room. "Now it is better. Your playing is mechanical, but that is not wrong. Bach was an organist. An organ is a sublime machine. The organist doesn't pump volume so his instrument wails or whimpers like a child. He doesn't slide the notes he plays one into another. He doesn't race his fingers through excitement or set the notes dragging because he is sad. He plays the instrument, not his moods. Show the cello some respect. Treat it like Bach would treat an organ." He stepped across the room and moved the music stand to one side. "Now play again. Close your eyes, keep them Shut tight and play. Only play. Otto began. Birkendorf's boots clicked their way over to the door, where they paused a moment and then returned. He stopped and stood a little way to Otto's right. The air still smelled of the vinegared water Otto used to wipe the flooring, but inside that was the adjutant's own scent of carbolic soap, and it was still. Yet within that was a new scent. Lavender, rose water, lemon, maybe freesia, he didn't know. Some chemical concoction of summer infused by skin. Otto opened his mouth to take it in and kept on playing. His eyes were shut against the brightness and he screwed them tighter. The man wanted the playing to be mechanical, then he could have mechanical. Otto soared through to the end of the prelude. He needed to read the music to play further, so instead of playing the Allemande, he went da capo and started again. The cello rocked and twisted as he played. It would have stamped out the rhythm if it had legs.
Thank you, Martin. Well, according to your afterword to the novel, it had a very lengthy gestation period, and I wondered when the idea first came to you.
The idea hit me, literally, in the summer of 1997. I was walking in the mountains, the Teton Mountains of America, and went and stood on a tree trunk. And this idea literally slammed into my head, and a light fell around me like snow. And it was the basics of the idea were all there, the whole novel. I later learned that the same thing happened to E.M. Forster in 1902, travelling above Ravello, and he termed it a gift of the god of place, the genius Loki. When he got his, he ran down the mountain and wrote A Story of a Panic. He wrote that in a week. It took me 20 years because it was just a very big and profound idea.
And there's a very high barrier to entry, if you like, to set a book around the Holocaust. I've spoken to a lot of German writers about this, and I think they often find it almost presumptuous, mm-hmm. if I could issue that challenge to you. Did you feel that?
I did. I was incredibly daunted and somewhat scared because you don't really enter the Holocaust and all those horrors voluntarily. But for me, one of the routes that I took was to make sure that I linked this novel to the historical record. When I went to Dachau and I went to Auschwitz and spent a lot of time there, I was literally floored. And what I felt there was this immense blanket of sorrow. And for me, as a writer, when I feel something like that, what I get is millions of stories that never got to express themselves. An important time for me was talking with Helen Bamber, who entered Belsen as a young woman. And what she learned there was that the keenest wish of those people that had survived the camps was not food. It was somebody to hear their tales. What I feel is that millions of people were completely extinguished. Their stories went with them. So it's a purpose of writers to actually go and get those stories that nonfiction will never find. So imagine your way in and tell those stories, tell the stories of people that actually suffered the worst.
And you also had looked at German post-war response to the Third Reich and to the Holocaust in your first novel called On Bended Knees. And tell me about your experience that led up to that, because you were on a youth exchange in the mid-1970s, which doesn't sound that long ago, but is a very sort of different world in terms of coming to terms with the Holocaust and the question of German guilt.
It was surprisingly historic now, but then the idea was to keep the notion of Berlin alive, keep it alive in people's minds in the West. So I went there as an 18-year-old. I worked in a department store, and my landlord was on the Nazi war crimes register. He feared leaving Berlin. So that he became the subject of that first novel, On Bended Knees. And you got deep inside the Nazi mind just through the months and months of being with him. He relaxed and told us the story. So he was telling me how Hitler had restored order where there was crime. When he really came to know me well, he gave me a souvenir postcard of Berchtesgaden. He was a man that had shot down the first Wellington bomber who was imprisoned in Russia, who then came back and spent a life teaching, retired from teaching to become a doctor, and then tried to find a cure for death. When I went back to see him the following year, he'd actually bought a sanatorium and offered me a free course of injections. And so it's a, it was a different mindset. And then I went also to, I had a pen friend, and she was in East Berlin, and I went with her to visit her aunt living in Dresden. So you're walking through the bombed ruins of Dresden, and you go into this small house of this woman who she's surrounded by postcards of her dead son in his war uniform, who had been killed by the English. And she could barely bear to look at me, but it really wakens you to recognise that war has many sides, and the effects of war are passed on through the generations.
And that's absolutely one of the themes here, that this takes us through, I think, almost a 50-year cycle of the impact of the events. But when you were writing about the Holocaust, or at least starting your story there, does it impose certain obligations or even restrictions on you as a writer, where you think, oh, I can't just make things up? Things do have to be historically grounded, not least for the reason that I mentioned in the introduction, that there is a growing doubt and forgetfulness, or purposeful forgetfulness of facts.
One of the real dangers that I found of entering this arena with fiction was almost becoming complicit in Nazi horrors. If you're inventing more to go into it, there are so many horrors that we just know nothing about. So what I determined to do was anchor this in historical fact by reading history books, by reading memoir, by interviewing people, and by site visits. So none of the actual crucial incidents that happened aren't sourced, in fact. And that, for me, was what gave the book the strength that it has as well. I was trying to avoid things like taking my book to Auschwitz. I thought, no, that's kind of too obvious in a fictional way. The town of Terezin in the Czech Republic is fundamental to any novel about music, because that's where the next lineage of Czech musicians were sent to be killed. My characters didn't seem to be going there when I kept the historical record. And then you look at the women that were left behind in Vienna and realise that they were indeed sent to Terezin and from there to Auschwitz. So keeping things true to fact really brought in huge dimensions of the Holocaust.
Music is at the heart of this novel, and all the contested relationships in it from the Third Reich onwards. And the two principal characters are preeminent cellist, composer, and a highly regarded musicologist whose stories are going to intertwine. But I noticed, as someone who loves classical music, that the way that the composition and performance of music is threaded through is very detailed. What did your research involve? How did you go at that?
The cello suites of J.S. Bach became my surround sound for decades. But then it was also going to a lot of concerts of mid-20th century music and buying those records, listening to those all the time. For me, a particularly revelatory time was listening to Messiaen's Music for the End of Time in the Aldeburgh Festival. I'd heard it lots of times, but then you some this one moment when you hear this piece and it inverts you, you know, and that was important to me.
We heard a snippet of Pablo Casals playing at the top of the programme. Do you have a sense or a sound in your head of how Otto plays? Is he very different?
Yeah, he was impressed himself by Casals' music. It starts with the 78s of that spinning around in Vienna in 1938. But for me, the closest sound I got for him was Daniil Shafran, the Russian cellist, because it's wild and exuberant and savage, not that controlled.
No, not yes, exactly, not that. No. He certainly wasn't playing in anything like that sort of spirit. And something else that the novel then deals with, which follows from the music, it follows from the history, and it follows from the dreadful central fact of the Holocaust, is who owns these stories, and that gap between the sort of biography that we know about and the many stories, I think you've referred to, that we don't. Do you have feelings about who owns these stories, and what are the rights of the retellers?
Yes, I've wondered about my own rights to tell the story, but I live and the people that had the deepest right to tell this story were all killed. Not a single one came out of those gas chambers to tell their story. So for me, their stories have to be told. So it wasn't a comfortable thing for me to do. I didn't particularly want that right. It came to me more like a huge responsibility than a right. And those stories now are very real for me. Nothing I've ever written affects me as much as this. So for me, these are true stories, but they're emblematic. And I really wrote these stories for those characters, not for anybody else. It's to give voice to people that never had their own voice.
Thank you, Martin Goodman. And J.S.S. Bach is published on the 9th of March.
Hitler marched into Austria a weekend, and on the 13th, 14th of March, 38, and I went to university and was told not to come back again. By luck, the English tutor gave introduction to the passport officer in the British Embassy, and there was a rather moving scene. I went there with my mother, trying to get a visa, and the man said, well, you haven't got sufficient proof that you can support yourself financially and won't be a burden to the British taxpayer. And my mother started to cry and said, that's my only child and my husband is in prison. What am I going to do? So he said, rather ill-tempered, all right, give me the passport. Stamped in 3 months, transmigration visa. The passport officer has since been revealed as the head of MI6 in Central Europe.
The publisher, George Weidenfeld, speaking in 2013 about how he escaped from Austria following the German invasion in 1938. He was one of some 50,000 émigrés who arrived in Britain at the end of the 1930s, fleeing from Nazi Europe. Insiders, Outsiders is a year-long festival, launching in March, and it celebrates the impact those refugees had on British culture. Art historian Monica Bohm-Dutchen initiated the festival. She's with me now, along with the social and cultural historian Daniel Snowman. So, Monica, what specifically inspired this project now?
It goes back, I suppose, semi-consciously many years. I've been very personal, as Martin has been. I'm the daughter of both parents who came just in time, and my father in particular suffered the profoundest of losses about which he could never talk. My mother is still alive. I'm doing it partly for them, and that is utterly personal and not the whole story. But as an art historian, I have for many years, in fact, going back almost to the beginning of my career now, been intrigued, preoccupied with issues to do with art and trauma, displacement, war, the Holocaust, Jewish identity, and it all begins to kind of interconnect and intersect. More specifically, the idea for this particular project, which has become rather overwhelmingly huge and you know, way beyond my wildest expectations, I have to admit, goes back about 2 years when I was in conversation with a fellow curator about a very specific small project, actually looking at an area which is indeed of great interest and pertinent to the wider festival. That's looking actually at the area of Hampstead in Northwest Three as a remarkably rich and fertile creative hub, particularly in the later 30s and 40s, when so many of these creative émigrés came to that particular area of London and mixed very fruitfully with those already on the ground. And I suppose just in the course of that conversation, I suddenly realised that it had the potential to become something very much larger.
And who are the principal figures here in your exhibition?
I suppose starting with the visual arts, which is what I know most about, I'll leave music to the others, perhaps more expert than me, to discuss. The big names, I suppose, would be people like Oskar Kokoschka, by most people's reckoning now, you know, a major figure in an essentially expressionist mode of making images in the 20th century, particularly Germanic mode, which was seen as entirely alien in this country. And I think it's worth mentioning that he and others of the same expressionist ilk really were virtually unknown, and those who did know them, for the most part, were deeply hostile to that kind of art making. Ludwig Meidner is another example of that. Then, rather differently, you have people like Kurt Schwitters, who, again, was quite neglected, unknown by most people here, but from really the sort of 70s onwards, sort of really many decades on, has become a very influential, almost sort of a seminal figure in mixed media, sort of experimental art making. John Hartfield, the pioneer of political montage. And I suppose, again, a lot of people know these names, certainly in the art world, but perhaps didn't realise they came to this country. So their injection of a new, what was seen as a very foreign, radical, experimental, anti-English, almost alien way of thinking about art was absolutely crucial.
And Daniel, what's your personal connection to this generation of émigrés? As a historian or something more?
Well, despite my funny name, I'm not a Schneemann. My own background, in fact, goes back to an earlier migration. But I was brought up in northwest London, and I knew that anybody, you know, called Schmidt was automatically going to be 10% cleverer than anybody called Smith. And my parents would take me to concerts, and, you know, the conductor might be Beecham or Sargent or something, but it might be Otto Klemperer, or it might be Rudolf Schwarz, or it might be Georg Scholti. And I gradually grew up realising that, as Monica quite rightly says, in all the arts, in all aspects of culture, my generation was enriched in part by these migrants from Central Europe. And what they tended to bring was something of a culture very different from that of domestic Britain. Domestic Britain was rural, imperial, Lutyens doing Georgian and Elizabethan kind of revival architecture, Vaughan Williams writing variations on Tudor music and so on. And in come these people, lucky to survive the dangers of Central Europe. Many of them lost their parents. Many of them were nearly killed themselves. But what they brought to British culture was something totally different. It was a kind of urban Weimar cabaret tough Bauhaus architecture with glass, steel and concrete, Schoenbergian modern 12-tone music. And these two totally different cultures met and gradually adjusted to each other, with the result that my generation, we're talking about music around this table, learnt to love not just some of the conductors I met, some of the composers we could talk about, some of the pianists, violinists, the Amadeus Quartet, three of whom were refugees from Nazi Vienna.
They used to joke, the Amadeus Quartet, didn't they, that they'd met in prison. Did many of the people we're talking about also find themselves in internment camps in this time after the outbreak of war?
Yes, many of the refugees, the émigrés, most of them, as I think we've already said, arriving in the late 1930s, very lucky to get out when they did, were still citizens of the Third Reich, i.e. Germany, Austria. It was wider by then than just Germany, and therefore technically enemy aliens. And that was OK for a bit, but once Nazi Germany had begun to sort of flood across Western Europe and take France and so on, Britain felt very threatened, and the new government of Churchill thought, well, we better intern the lot, get them away from London just in case there are German spies among them, who knows that there might not be, send them up to the kind of northwest, Lancashire and so on, then across to the Isle of Man. And the three refugee members of the Amadeus Quartet, they didn't actually meet in the same spot, but all three of them were among the internees who were fairly soon afterwards let out and were obviously innocent, and they did their best for the British war effort.
Monica, what was the general attitude of the public to this influx of refugees?
Well, sticking perhaps to, you know, what we'll term for convenience, the creative émigrés, I mean, there's absolutely no doubt that in many professional contexts, for example, in the world of music, for one, but also, just another example, the world of picture restorers, there was distinct professional jealousy. I mean, how dare these international, cosmopolitan, more sophisticated upstarts come and threaten our livelihood? So you have, I mean, there's concrete evidence.
Must have been tricky.
Must have been tricky, and one has to try to understand that. I agree. But there is a very concrete example, which one of my colleagues in this project, who's incidentally contributed an essay on the subject to the anthology being published by Lund Humphreys in early March, looking primarily at the visual arts. But she's done some very disconcerting research, which proves that the Association of Picture Restorers was consciously and very pointedly renamed the British Association of Picture Restorers in order to exclude, by rule, yes, those not of British birth. But equally, as a counter to that, I think it's really important to be aware that there were individuals, think of Vaughan Williams, for example, in music, Kenneth Clarke in the world of the visual arts. They were a minority, but there were those who were already predisposed to be very international in their outlook and who immediately formed alliances, if you like, with the incomers.
In the anthology that Monica has just referred to, Daniel, you've written, sympathy for the victims of Nazism was one thing, serious interest or admiration for their work another. So was there considerable resistance to these new ways of seeing, looking and ultimately making art?
Oh, yes, I think there was. Of course, people had sympathy for those who were trying to escape from the horrors of Nazism. You know, we all now, the moment you read about what's actually going on in Syria or Yemen, of course, how terrible, what can we do to help them? But, first of all, there was resistance to migration on a large scale, then as now in many ways. And equally, the culture that these people were bringing with them, the harshness, the modernity, the Bauhaus architecture, the music that didn't quite sort of fit, the paintings that were crude and rude and cabaret and showed private parts, there was a lot of resistances. How can you really call that art? art is Augustus John and beautiful traditional houses with lovely beams and thatch and so on. We wish them well, but there was indeed an exhibition of some of their work put on in the later 1930s, and one of the critics, a rather famous critic, said, well, you know, if Hitler hates that kind of thing, it's one of the best things I've heard about Hitler.
Were there particular individuals, Monica, and institutions that were supporting these artistic incomers?
Yes, and it is important, I think, you know, to pay tribute to those against, as Daniel quite rightly says, general, not overt necessarily hostility, but sort of reluctance to do terribly much to help. And that, of course, includes government policy. So, for example, going back to the Hampstead context, an artist from Prague contacted a rather wonderful anti-fascist activist woman called Margaret Gardner, patron of the likes of Barbara Hepworth and Ben Nicholson, going back to the British, you know, contingent, pleading for help because, of course, Prague also was no longer safe in the late 1930s. And she literally crossed the road to her neighbour, Roland Penrose, partner of Lee Miller, very much with strong Quaker belief that predisposed him to be sympathetic to those in need of help. In turn, he sort of literally walked a few yards up the road to number 47 Downshire Hill, which was the residence of a couple who were to play a really important part. He was Fred Ullmann. He was a refugee himself of German-Jewish origin. Had been, in fact, a social democrat lawyer who instantly got into trouble with the Third Reich, but happened to marry Diana Ullmann, who was a British aristocrat. And they wanted, you know, collectively, they formed something called the Artist Refugee Committee. And the great and the good, I mean, you mentioned Augustus John, and I think, again, this reminds one has to be perhaps a little bit more nuanced in the way we look at this cultural terrain. Augustus John, I think I'm right in saying, was actually one of the patrons of the Artist Refugee Committee. So it actually garnered support from a surprising range of different people who wanted to help.
Martin, I thought listening to this, having written your novel based around the music of the period, how much did the reception of music, I mean, we know what Hitler thought of it, we know the way that it was weaponized against artists and intellectuals, but the public reception of music, styles of playing, more avant-garde ways of treating great works, it's a really fascinating subject in itself over the period that you're describing.
It is. For me, you know, I had my character leave and head to Canada, where there were completely new ranges in bits that didn't quite make it into the final volume. He was actually training up Glenn Gould. So I think what actually happened was that brazen individuality was then supported. People were looking for some different ways. And I think, actually, it became a story of who collaborated and who didn't, who was sympathetic and who was not. That became one of the dominant themes, as far as I know. Is that what you found at all, Daniel?
I think two and two tended to make five, and occasionally three. I mean, there was a gradual integration of what the émigrés brought and what was already in Britain, and both changed, and between them they enriched the country of their new homeland, their new Heimat. But that's always been true. We talk again and again about British culture, British independence, get our sovereignty back and so on. But as I look over British history, there have been waves and waves of people from elsewhere, from the Romans. I'm talking to you in a language that partly goes back to the Angles and Saxons and the French Normans, the Huguenots, etc., etc., all of whom were in different ways resented, fought against, and at the same time those who stayed and got here integrated with what was already there, and things changed as a result. That was true of this particular wave of migrants, where they were simply one of many waves of migration to this country. And at the moment we talk about a new wave, and I'm sure that if we meet again in 50 years' time, we will see how that too has in its own ways integrated with what was already here.
The Festival of Britain also plays a quite fundamental role in this story, doesn't it?
Indeed, that's an interesting subject, and it is one of the ironies, going back to the whole question of the British internment camps, that a disproportionate number of those who had come in the late 30s were in 1951, or indeed in the run-up to the 1951 Festival of Britain, duly employed, commissioned by those in positions of authority to glorify, to celebrate the position of Britain post-war. So yes, indeed. And really, there are, you know, Peter Morrow, for example, one of the main movers and shakers behind the festival hall, just to name, you know, one example.
And what form will your own festival take? Because there's so many ways that you could go about this. It's such an elastic the subject. How are you going about it?
It's been a challenge to contain and shape it, but what's been happening in the time I've been working on the project is that the festival has become a big umbrella for a multitude, a really diverse array of events in different art forms happening over this year-long period, for the most part coming from within other institutions. So just to name some of the best known, you have the National Portrait Gallery, the Tate Gallery, the Trinity Laban Conservatoire, the Royal College of Music, Glyndebourne, all becoming part of this wider enterprise. And of course, 2019, as the 80th anniversary of the outbreak of the Second World War, seems the most apposite time to be doing what we're doing.
And ostensibly, of course, this marks 80 years since those émigrés first came to the UK. But Daniel, there's something a bit pointed, isn't there, about highlighting cultural contribution of refugees in 2019?
It continues to be a large subject, a major subject, or in fact it's been revived as a major subject. It's interesting, I think the whole topic that we're talking about, very large topic immediately after the war, and when I was writing my book about some of these people, I was able to interview a great many of them at some length, including George Weidenfeld, for example, who's voice we just heard, and many another, Klaus Moser, art historians and film people. And then it went off the boil for a bit. It was less interesting. Things moved on. Many of them died. And I think now, 2019, it's not only the 80th anniversary of the outbreak of the war, kinder transport, etc., but also, as you quite rightly say, the whole question of migration has become a major international subject, a major British subject, part of what the Brexit debate is about. And I think Monica is quite right in having brought up this festival at this particular time.
Martin, you wanted a last word.
I was impressed how many women artists you've found to enter your programme, looking through your catalogue. I wonder how hard that was. My understanding is that when a lot of those men that could afford to buy their way out fled Germany, they left the women behind because they felt the women would be safe, so they would have come here on their own. And then I look at the examples of Elias and Visa Canetti, and one gets fame and the Nobel Prize, the other writes probably one of the most important books about Kristallnacht, Tortoises, the great novel, that didn't get published in her lifetime. So how hard was it to bring these women to the foreground?
It wasn't a conscious decision to do that. I am absolutely delighted that so many women indeed feature so prominently in the project. Just as a point of fact, you may not be aware that in an almost ironic sense or paradoxical way, it was easier for women in the late 30s to come to this country as domestic servants. They needed a guarantee of employment to enable them to come. So many of these, often very cultured, essentially affluent and middle-class women, found themselves as domestic servants, which in itself must have been a difficult adjustment. But that's just a point of fact. You're absolutely right. I mean, there are too many women, as in the history of Western culture, who have been sidelined, who indeed may have been quite successful in their own lifetimes. Greta Marx, the ceramicist, is one example. There are many, many others one could bring to bear on this. And it's their turn, in a sense, but it hasn't been any great effort because the material, the stories, the evidence of their creativity is ripe for the taking, if you like, and ready to be shown to the world.
Daniel?
While it's obviously quite right that we should include as many women in the whole project as we possibly can, and there were some very outstanding ones in many of the arts, we also have to remember that they were coming from what we would now think of as a rather old-fashioned sexist society in which the man, you know, produced the films and directed this and wrote that and stood up and had the money and the rest of it. And the woman's job, I remember people like Klaus Moser, Lord Moser, saying this, you know, she would look after the estate, the household, the servants, prepare for a dinner because a lot of important bankers and artists are all coming this evening. And it wasn't a society in which women composers would be writing operas or directing films. It was what we would now look back upon as a sexist society in which the male roles and the female roles were very different.
There were notable exceptions. I would count to that one.
You can continue to battle that one out. Thank you, Monica Bohm-Duchen, Daniel Snowman and Martin Goodman there. The Insiders Outsiders Festival starts at the beginning of March and runs for a year, taking in events throughout the UK. There's also a book to accompany the festival, Insiders, Outsiders, Refugees from Nazi Europe and Their Contribution to British Visual Culture. In our next edition, Camille Paglia, Slavoj Žižek and Fleming Rose won't be afraid to ruffle a few feathers when Philip Dodd asks, can causing offence be a good thing? I hope you won't be offended if I say that from me and my producer Torquil MacLeod. That's your lot for now. Goodbye. Thanks for listening. You can find out more from our archives and further information about the guests and topics discussed by looking up the Free Thinking programme website on BBC Radio 3. If we've whetted your appetite for more discussions about arts and ideas, you might be interested in other BBC podcasts too. Start the week Thinking Aloud and In Our Time. Or if you prefer talks, do search out Radio 3's The Essay.